Hans Hacker, we're standing at the German Pavilion now. We can hear the sounds of people walking across the fractured paving stones in the pavilion, but could you describe what the underlying concerns of this work are?
As I often do, I work with the context. There's the word site specificity in the art world since a number of years. The context in this case is the Biennale in general. It is the German pavilion of the Biennale. What was exhibited in the German pavilion, the people who came, among others also Hitler. The architecture of the pavilion, which was restyled in 1938. And then very much so also the present. The dates on the emblem above the door is 1990, the date of the reunification of Germany, and also the currency adjustment. And inside, I make reference both to the past as well as to the present.
In fact, you have an image as you come in the door of Hitler actually visiting this pavilion to see an exhibition. Was that in a way a starting point for this work? I mean, because it's site-specific, but historically specific too.
It was not really a starting point, but it it underlines that this pavilion has a political history, and that art exhibitions, including an exhibition like the Biennale, also plays a political function, something that we often overlook or try to forget. It locates the art world in the general social environment. Hitler, as you know, also had his ideas about art, but it would be wrong to focus exclusively on this image. It is one of the ingredients with which I'm working.
I mean, how do you want the work to be read? I mean, in that sort of metaphorical sense, because clearly it's not only to do with Hitler and to do with history. I mean, as you were saying, it's to do with politics, which are just as prevalent today, but in different ways, perhaps implicit rather than explicit.
Well, it is, of course, a metaphoric work. I do not provide information that was not available before. Maybe people were not aware that Hitler visited the Biennale and that there was and that he was guided by an Italian general secretary in a fascist uniform.
What about the floor? Because that's been entirely ripped up, and in fact it's now uneven, and it's just it's like a building site. What were you attempting to say through doing that?
Well, as I said, in 1938, the pavilion was restyled by an architect from Munich, following the example of the new Haus der Deutschen Kunst that Hitler had unveiled and opened a year earlier in Munich. So this is a monument of sorts of Nazi architecture here. And it was in 1938 that the parquet floor that was in the pavilion until then was replaced by marble slabs. And it is these marble slabs that I ripped out and that are strewn all over, and as if a storm went through the building. And then you in terms of figures of speech that we all have in our language, you can extrapolate metaphorically what it means that the ground is broken up.
The work has made a very strong impression. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people now and they refer to this, a lot of people refer to it. However, there are those that are also very angry about it, and I'm thinking of Jan Hoot, who I was speaking to yesterday. Are you concerned about that sort of reaction?
No, I'm not concerned. I'm sometimes surprised because I, of course, am trying to figure out what motivates Jan Hood and a few others to burst out in anger. What is behind that? And since I haven't spoken to him, I haven't heard what he had to say directly, and we had no chance to discuss this. I cannot respond to reasoning that I'm unfamiliar with.
I think it's to do with the use of history and this reference to Hitler and the past that he believes should be disengaged with.
Well, maybe he is fortunate enough to have been born in a country in which Hitler did not play the role that he did. And therefore, it's not a problem for him.
So finally, has the work met up to your expectations in its realization? I mean, presumably, this was conceived in the abstract, so to speak, and now it's realized. I mean, do you feel it's the powerful work that you intended?
Well, with most of the works that I make, since they are site-specific, I cannot test them before they go public, so to speak. And so it's always a gamble. My impression at the moment, judging by the reaction of the majority of people and also the quality of these reactions, is that the gamble, so to speak, panned out. I met a lot of people, particularly people of my generation, who were rather moved, much more moved than I ever expected, and particularly those people who either personally or due to relations in their family went through hell seemed to be extremely moved to the point that I've seen some of them close to tears.
It's certainly extremely physically challenging as well as conceptually challenging walking through the space and not being secure on the ground because of the way in which the slabs are uneven and smashed up and broken up, and it has a sense in which physically you have to orientate toward the work as well as mentally.
I'm glad that I can manage with practically no words in this piece, and that of course is something that is a particular challenge and a particular problem in an international setting like the Biennale, where I cannot presume that everybody speaks English or German, or it would have been extremely cumbersome had I had to resort to words in order to clarify things. I've done works in the past that were extremely wordy, and it was quite clear to me that this was absolutely out of the question in this setting.
Just finally, did you conceive of this work before you visited the pavilion, or did this arise out of a visit and subsequent research?
I did not think of what I would do here until I saw the pavilion both on the outside as well as the inside twice, both in the winter as well as in the summer. I came first time around in the winter. But I was aware of the fact that lighting conditions, the general atmosphere here would be drastically different in the summer. And therefore I came back and I sat in the pavilion for a while, and it was probably the sense that I got from the site, that the physicality of the site, that eventually led me to think about the building as such being the material of the work. I also was fortunate, I should say, to get hold of a dissertation that had not been published yet on the history of the German Pavilion, and I familiarized myself with the history of the biennial, and all of these things gave me the background that eventually led to something that is, as I hope, charged without using many words.
Well, Lawrence Wiener, perhaps you could talk about the reasons as to why you're here in Venice.
I'm participating in a performance of a group of people I work with in Vienna called Die Damen that very often take on using its four artists and using whatever sophistication one has with media and with performance to deal with issues and to deal with certain kinds of visual presentation that, in a sense, doesn't have anything to do with our work, and in the other sense has to do with why we do the work. And I'll be doing a performance with them on Friday. That's the only reason I'm in Venice, and I was on my way to Rotterdam, and it just seemed quite logical to stop in Venice and see what other people are doing.
Tell me a little bit more about the performance, then. Where is it, and what does it comprise?
It'll be at Piazza San Marco tomorrow afternoon, and I think you'll understand it when you see it. Let's say it has to do with pigeons and pigeon shit.
What sort of impression have you got of this event so far?
I've seen only two other biennales in my entire life, and it seems to be okay. I mean, it's very hard to have all of these sort of national pavilions. You quite wonder whether it's an Olympics or not, but it seems to be working. I've seen a lot of work that's interesting and a lot of people who I think should be showing, so I don't have any problems with it. I'm not a dealer or a museum person. I'm just an artist looking at art.
Do you have any critique of it as a model of presenting, exposing contemporary art in 1993?
It's as good as any. I don't know what a model is. I mean, art fairs have outlived their usefulness. And this, if it doesn't function as an art fair, it's a rather good place for a lot of people from all over the world to talk to each other. And maybe at this point an excuse for people to talk to each other is not so bad.
Finally, I mean, would you be interested in making a work for a Venice Biennale?
Oh, that's a very complicated thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm an American and I like being an American, but I don't know how I'd feel representing a country.
Right.
I genuinely don't. I'd have to come to the point of having to do it.
What about the American Pavilion with Louise Bourgeois? Have you been there?
Yes, I have. It's quite nice. It's quite nice that they have an artist who has a full body of work. But the idea of wearing a national flag on your back, I'm not so sure about it. But one changes one's mind in different contingencies.
But that mold has been somewhat broken or fractured this year by pavilions having artists who aren't necessarily identified immediately with the country and
artists that were brought in as guest workers and things. But it's usually fine. I mean, it's broken, but it's still quite basically there.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at European football. You don't have to be born in the country to be wearing the country's colors. It's what colors you put on. Our life is uniforms. It's not genetic blood. I mean, that's why this Hans Hocker installation is rather interesting. It's at a time where the conversation is your patrie, your fatherland, in a sense, is the place you choose to be in 1993. So when you put on a jacket, and if it says Sony, if it says Great Britain, that's what it says. If I ever have to make the decision to put on a team jacket, I'll just have to make the decision, and we'll see what happens. Probably I can rationalize my way through it, but at this particular moment, I have doubts.
And now, an electronic leap to New York to speak to Yoko Ono, who has a piece in the Biennale, but had to leave before we could arrange an interview. So we're recording this interview with her in New York. Yoko, could we start by you describing your work in the Biennale?
It's an environment piece, or shall we say an installment. And it was a one room, rather cathedral-like, high ceiling, with skylight, and so forth. And I set it up, the one room, as two rooms. And on a conceptual level, the two rooms represented East and the West, the Eastern culture and the Western culture, which are two cultures that are within me.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a statue of Christ on the wall, and the whole room is painted as sky, even the floor. And in the sky, there's the Christ on the wall, and also there's a Bible in front of it, and church pews, three church pews. There's a holy water bowl,
mm-hmm.
in which there are pieces of sky that you can take it when you come there into this church-like atmosphere. And then there's a little closet-like space that's kind of separated, and inside there's a body lying down with a blanket over it, covering the face and the body, and just the feet sticking out. And on the wall, there's a sign, kind of graffiti, that says, "Spiritual fanaticism breeds physical terrorism.
Right.
Pray for humanity." And it's a kind of graffiti that's done on the bare wall.
What are the underlying themes of the work? I mean, were they themes that have interested you and occupied you for some time, or did you respond to one of the themes of the Biennale itself?
Initially, when they told me that I'm going to be represented in the Asian section, I thought that was quite interesting. And suddenly, my Asian roots came out, I suppose. And from where I see it as an Asian, there's such a exchange of culture, and the Western and the Eastern culture always together growing in us. I think that is not a reality of a regular Western person, because Western person more or less tend to live inside the Western culture, and the Eastern culture is kind of outside, somewhere out there in the third world. But coming from the so-called third world, the third world is always aware of the Western culture, which in one way or the other permeated our culture, and so that there's always those two cultures, the memory of two cultures in us. And so I wanted to show the fusion of those two cultures. The pain of being that persecuted race, pain of being the other.
In a way, whilst you've been talking, I've been thinking about the curator's agenda for this Biennale, which seems to reflect a lot of the issues that you've discussed, that is, of one culture addressing another, the movement of people across national frontiers and through various ideologies and beliefs. So in a way, this Biennale has been a very suitable context for you to explore things that preoccupy you.
Well, when I was asked to present my piece in the Biennale, I was not aware how appropriate it was to present this work. I'm very happy about that. And The Road to Asia is the title that really gave me the inspiration, gave me a feeling of going back to my roots.
Can I just return to one element of the installation? If I can refer to the figure partially covered by the blanket, which gives a sense of a slain individual, is that meant to be read specifically, or is it a much more general reference?
Well, I think an act of genocide happened everywhere, and we are all victims of it. I think the history of human race is the history of violence, and instead of blaming each other, we should realize that we're all victims of it.
And now back to David Elliott in Venice.
David, do you have any overriding impression at this stage of the Biennale?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that this year is certainly much better in terms of the pavilions than the Biennale before. I feel there's a much greater range, and also the quality, the general quality is much higher. I think the other thing is that they have made a real attempt here to bring in non-Western art. And although the display leaves a lot to be desired, I'm very interested by the way how Japanese modernism and contemporary Chinese art have been integrated into the Biennale.
So you think the way in which the mold has been broken here, or fractured, that of dissolving the kind of national identity of individual pavilions, has been a sort of step forward?
Yes, I think it's in a way this year it's a bit of a gimmick, really, and the reason the national pavilions is it's one of the ways in which the whole thing gets funded. And if they find an alternative way of funding it, fine. But I mean, I guess the national identity is something that's there for economic reasons as much as any sort of nationalistic or patriotic reasons.
Do you think because they've opened up the main site to a lot more artists, and the Italian pavilion, for instance, now is given over to countries that don't have pavilions for themselves, there is a sense in which the distinction between the aperto and the main pavilion seem to me to be slightly dissolved this year?
Yeah, in a sense that's true, and of course there are a lot of people who were in the aperto last time who are now in the main pavilions, but I think the hierarchies are still very much there, particularly in the way that the new countries are displayed in the Italian pavilion. But that said, I mean, it's the thin end of the wedge, and I think that by showing work that is from outside the normal range, it's a definite advance. And of course, it only makes sense if the work's any good. And in my view, some of the work is a very, very high quality.
Mm. Are there any particular high points that you will go away remembering in terms of displays?
Yes. For me, the German pavilion made a tremendous impact. I know it's much hated by many people, and my German friends have said it's far too simplistic, and the situation is much worse and much more complicated than Harker's piece suggests. But for me, just the physical impact of going into that space, and then the feeling of it, and also Harker's own sense of obduracy are so strong that it's a very strong work, and I think will be remembered for many, many years.
Mm.
Also, I mean, the other pavilion, which is just next to it, is the Japanese pavilion of Kusama Yayoi. And for me, she's been really the preeminent Japanese living artist for many years, rather neglected because she lived a long time abroad, and also, of course, she's a woman. But it was very good to see her here making a performance in the environment that she made, and also a big range of her work. Of course, the display is far too packed. There's far too much of it in there, but nonetheless, there's some absolutely top quality works of the early 60s, which put her on the map as a leading painter of that generation, leading New York painter of that generation, because that's where she was living, and one of the pictures actually belongs to Frank Stella. But she's rather been lost from the history books, quite wrongly.
Mm.
And where we're standing now in front of the medical hermeneutics group is an example of the later conceptualism that took over in Moscow in the late 80s up to the present is also very interesting for me to see.
So there's a sense in which the sort of whole model has been rejuvenated or regenerated this year.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one would say almost in spite of the commissioner it's being a success. I think there's a spirit of openness. And the kind of sloppiness, which will always be there and which is so often frustrating, also has its plus side, because it's actually opening up some gaps for some new things to live and breathe.
Well, I'm now in the Australian Pavilion, about to talk to Judy Anea, who is the Australian Commissioner. Judy, it would be interesting to first of all talk about how you actually went about your selection of Jenny Watson for this exhibition.
Well, in Australia, the Australia Council as the cultural agency administers the pavilion and so on, they advertise for proposals. So it's a sort of, you know, anyone can apply. So I applied and proposed Jenny for a whole variety of reasons. It seemed to me that in the pavilions one needed artists who were quite mature, not necessarily in age, but in terms of, you know, the strength of their work and their career and so on. So that was one consideration, and Jenny has been working for nearly 20 years. There were many considerations, in fact, the space, which is quite difficult for a lot of artists, and I knew Jenny would be able to deal with this kind of a space. Also, I think that the sort of strength of her, her toughness of mind in relationship to her work, which goes back to maturity, I guess. Also, she was carving out an international career for herself, so she wasn't a complete unknown in the European context. Also, Australia had never had a woman, a solo woman, in Venice, and it's interesting that both the Japanese and, all the Americans, I mean, they've got famous women in their pavilions this time. So I'm an independent curator, and I worked with what became the managing body, the Australian Exhibitions Touring Agency, in terms of putting the exhibition together, putting the catalogue together, doing all the design, the promotion, and so on.
What function do you think the Venice Biennale has, or appearing within it, from an Australian perspective, because it's a long, long way away, but clearly it has got a sort of international currency. I mean, how is it perceived from your perspective?
I think it's extremely important. Despite the fact that Australia, at a sort of federal level, is reorienting itself both politically, economically, and culturally towards Asia, the fact of the matter is that even though Australia is a multicultural society, and that includes a lot of people from different parts of Asia, we're still basically Western. And the sort of, like it or lump it, the cachet of being seen in Venice every 2 years is really quite a very important promotional event. And I think we're doing quite well this time because there's been a lot of interest in the exhibition. I mean, we're always trying to figure out other and better ways of having artists from Australia seen internationally, but this is the way it is at the moment, so we're trying to make the best of it in our pavilion.
Right. I mean, that whole multicultural debate within international contemporary art seems to be addressed much more so this year in the Biennale in relation to national pavilions, or some of the national pavilions seem to be exhibiting artists, although they might originate from that country, work abroad, and then the central Italian pavilion with spaces being given to countries that don't have pavilions. So there seems to be some conscious desire to engage with that debate this year.
Yes, I agree, although it's interesting that Benito Oliva has basically confined his theme to the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, yes, there are Latin American countries here and so on, in South Africa, but really, I think the European perspective of the Orient, it remains within a certain classic kind of mode, and it would be fascinating if in the next Venice Biennale it was possible for Europe, Venice, to go beyond that and look in more detail at the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, the North-South divide is a problem that has to be addressed on all levels, I think, including the cultural levels.
Jenny Watson, you're the representative here at the Venice Biennale for Australia. Before we talk about the works that you have in the pavilion, perhaps you could talk generally about what your view of being a participant in this Biennale is.
Well, the one thing I've noticed as an Australian, being in Europe a lot, exhibiting, and now at Venice, which I guess is the world premier art event apart from Documenta, is all the socialising, media activity and so on, which is so separate from the creation of works of art. That's something I've become really interested in since I started exhibiting outside of Australia, because in Australia it's still a relatively small almost backwater culture, even though I believe we do have all sorts of creative people that are world class. We don't have all the other activity that surrounds it. So to be a working artist in Australia can be extremely relaxed. You have your studio, you do your work, you have a show in Melbourne or Sydney. I live in the country, which exaggerates the sort of quiet studio element. And then when you come to be somewhere publicly to promote your work, you really have to switch into another gear. And that's the main thing I've noticed about Venice, that it's to do with the public presentation of art and artists and the growing art industry as such. It's become trendy to follow the art all around the world. Yeah, this is something that was not the case in the early 60s. It's a fantastic time. All the barriers have been broken down. Everybody knows that to be a good artist, you don't have to live in New York or Cologne. And it's anything goes on a lot of levels.
Can we talk about the works now that you have here in Venice? It seems to me that they're very substantially bound up in personal histories and personal experience. Perhaps, on the other hand, there are themes that run through the works, and I was wondering if you could identify some of the consistent themes that occupy you.
Yeah. Well, my work since the early 70s has always been diaristic. I don't know whether this is because I'm a woman. A lot of people seem to think that women need to produce something more personal rather than an intellectual part of being an art movement. But in the 70s, I dealt with very personal imagery, which was my family, the houses I lived in, texts, statements about things that I felt, my animals, and so on. But these works in the 70s were realistic painting. And in 1980, I started to move away from that and to do some works that were to do with the fracturing of thinking about one's position in the world and the fact that one was also making paintings. And there was a key work at that time in 1980 called Conversation Piece, where I broke up the frame of the painting and used 24 separate canvas boards, half of which were image and half of which were text, which was kind of about what I was seeing and what I was thinking. And the more interesting works from then on have been about that. It's to do with a perception of what's going on in the mind privately at the same time that one is perceiving. And that's why there seems to be such an interest in my work, because in the text I talk about things that usually don't go into the public art arena, you know, personal sadnesses, personal happinesses, just personal thinking. Often these sort of states you see in film, but they have not been an enormous issue in painting for some reason.
The works you have here in Venice, both are large panels, but also a piece of narrative on a separate panel next to the work. Mm. Well, it's part of the work. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the relationships between the primary panel and then a sort of dialogue that is going on next to it on a smaller panel.
Yeah. Well, the images, there are kind of five or six obsessive images, which is myself, my animals, which is cats and horses, my men friends, my house, and then various other random things that move in and out of it. But the images are fairly standard, which are used in different ways. Then the texts are this sort of internal dialogue that's continuing all the time, which is about my life, what I feel, what I want, what I perceive, how other people perceive me, and the state of what happens to the art objects once they are exhibited and put into the marketplace as such. These are the main things I'm interested in.
It's a dialogue on the activity and the context for the activity.
Yes, it's a consciousness of someone is watching me operate as an artist, whether that's one of my selves or I take the position of an outsider watching the show. This is, I think this is something that is peculiar to women, because women are enculturated to look at themselves, to constantly look in the mirror, to constantly care about their appearance, to constantly see how they're perceived. And so this concept of watching yourself and, oh, how does that look? What will people think? I think that's a particular female thing, which I've tried to feed into the intellectual dialogue.
Now I'm at the Polish Pavilion talking to Mirosław Balcha. Mirosław, could you first of all describe the works you have installed in this pavilion?
You know, just to explain by words, it's not so easy because it's a very big installation. But it consists of three parts, so it's some kind of triptych. And the first part is the corridor, which is 8 meters long and 160 centimeters wide, and the walls are high for 3 meters, but they are covered till the level of 190 centimeters, which is my high. We are covered with the thin coat of the grey soap, the soap which is the cheapest soap you can get. So this belt of soap on two sides leads you into the space, and this space is divided into two parts, left and right. And my intention was just to start to come into the first, into the part left, which is more active, and there are the works done from the steel, which is a little bit touched by the weather. Therefore, some signs of rust on the steel plates. And the other material I used there is the artificial carpet, which is turned upside down. And also there are some small pieces of used soaps and the steel rope and two trash cans, some kind of trash cans. So this is a very active part of this exhibition. And then when you see this, it's the right part, which is more peaceful, which is very horizontal, and consists of the terrazzo plate and heat and ash.
You've described the works not physically, but can you now talk about the underlying concerns and issues that you deal with as an artist?
The main size in this exhibition is the size of the floor of the kitchen in my studio, which I use as a module for and it's repeated in three moments. One first time is flat, the other time is it's like the form for something, and later it's just as a body.
Now, Ada, a Bratislavian critic and curator, I think you have some questions.
Yeah, I wrote in your catalogue that in any way you are related with your art in this installation with, you described in a way that you are related with the temperature, with the average temperature of the human being. And how is your work related? Because the title of your installation is 37.1. How it's related to your work? It's the average tension, or it's the average temperature?
This temperature of 37 is the normal temperature, so this point one has the rather symbolic meaning, and it's like the first step into the fever, or like the last step out of the fever. So this was the meaning of the title. And the one work has the heating cables, as you know, and they have the temperature, which I think that here it's much higher because of the temperature outside.
Could you, Anda, tell me something about your concept? Why you was choosing this artist, Miroslav Balka, to represent the Polish pavilion? Is it because his work is representing the current situation in Poland or not? Describe it.
My name is Anda Rotenberg. I'm the curator of the Pavilion of Polish Republic. I wouldn't even refer to the kind of current situation in Poland, because in the real art we can't spoke about the current situation. The situation describes the average, and I would rather stress the quality of art, which I took into consideration while choosing Miroslav, with whom I work over 8 years already. So I followed every step of his developing as artist, and I was convinced from the very beginning that he is really the very serious artist, the one who may give a real impact into the international art. It's not the problem of representativeness of the country only or not at the first row. The problem is to let the artist to make the real thing, a real piece of art, to be seen by the whole world. And my conviction is very simple. Miroslav Balka is simply a very good artist, and that's why he is here.
The issue was raised about the relationship between the state, between the political characteristics of Poland and your selection, and you seem to be saying that you weren't particularly concerned, but can you talk a little bit about Miroslav's work in relation to the context, because there must be some sort of set of links.
Yes, but I have to come back to the beginning of his activity, because he started his work as an independent artist in the mid of 80s, when we had the martial law, a very strange situation, because Poland was divided into two parts. One was official and the second one was unofficial. It was the majority. So the Poland was in a state of, let's say, disease, which lasted and lasted and lasted. And of course artists took part in this opposition, resurrection, if you want to say so. And after the time being, this kind of personal involvement of an artist into politics couldn't last forever. Our country did not hasn't got the same way for independence as the rest of, let's say, the bloc. We were, let's say, avant-garde. I don't want to exaggerate, but we started long before. So we were pretty tired in the mid of 80s, and one might feel it in the artist's work that he didn't want anymore to engage himself in the fight against the system, but because there was a permanent fighting all over and all around. So, but one couldn't avoid it in a way. So, for example, in the early works of Miroslav, and not even the works, but the activity, was of course in some way in the opposition to both, to the underground church movement and to the official movement. He raised up the personal story and the very personal point of view as a quality, which in my view was the claiming of something more than only the artistic statement. It was the attitude towards the politics, that the politics cannot interfere in the art. That's why I would say this is the very specific situation between politics and the generation of art, of artists who started in the 80s. And now what is he doing is also a kind of a reference to the very place in any level, but the language has changed only. But of course, his personal experience is deeper because it's longer. It's maybe more serious, and probably it is more serious than it was at the beginning, but the attitude didn't change so much.
Okay. Well, now, sitting with Maureen Paley. Maureen, do you have any particular opinion of the young British representatives selected by Matthew Slotover?
Well, one of the things I think that's interesting is that I think Matthew has made a very... he's made a strong selection. He comes off, I think, quite considered regarding Aperto. I think it's hard to discern what's happening entirely for people who are not familiar with the work in Aperto. But one of the things I like is that he's selected, for the most part, young British, and then he's also added to that. You know, he's added artists that are not necessarily from Britain. So he has that going on, and he's kind of has a questioning going on in his selection. But I also think it's interesting, too, that Angela Bullock has been invited by Nicolai Borio from France to participate, and that Henry Bond is also participating as a kind of a guest of another curator, Benjamin Weil. So there's a sense that I have that, in some ways, this notion of young British artists, which is strong and it's there, and I think very positive, is also slightly eroded in the fact that certain British artists have been invited by other curators that are international. And I think the fact that a great number of the younger artists that I'm working with and other people are working with are being taken up by curators and critics abroad and being seen to be important, not simply in the context of being young British artists or young British sculptors, but more as artists, is a very, very important point that we're embarking on, so that they can be included in Matthew's lineup. And that can look very, very interesting, and it can look very varied, but they can also be included in international groupings of artists and still hold their own. And I think this is the point that we wanted to get to, and I think it's a very interesting point that they've achieved that. I think also the large number of artists using sound, using video, using materials that are, let's say, you know, in a way extended media, is also very encouraging. It's an area that I've always had interest in, and it's an area that in a way has an important place. It's informational, and it's extremely interesting that to understand the Aperto requires you to spend a great deal of time with it. And sometimes people want to get this kind of quick fix, this quick reaction. They want to know what they're seeing immediately, get it in one, and I don't think you can get it in one. And it's actually required, this Biennale, many, many days. In the past, I would have visited churches, I would have looked at other examples of art from other periods in time, and I think it's fascinating that I've really had to spend a great deal of time at Biennale, and I've actually found it extremely interesting.